Okay, so today is April 19th, 2021. This is Chris Kretz for Stony Brook University Libraries interviewing Al DeVries for the COVID-19 Documenting Stony Brook University Experiences Project. Al, thank you first for sharing your experiences with us.
My pleasure, thanks.
And can you tell us to start what your position is here and how long you've been at the university?
Sure. So I'm Al DeVries. I'm the Director of Housing Administration within Campus Residences, and I've been at Stony Brook since January of 1977.
Okay, so there's a lot to talk about. So if you think back to January, February of 2020, before COVID hit, what were the types of things in your position that you were working on or taking care of?
Sure. So pre-COVID, that point of time in the year, we would have been gearing up for really our housing cycle for the year. So contract renewal for folks that are currently living with us, gearing up for applications from incoming students for the next academic year, planning for summer housing, recruiting for staff. We would have been gearing up for our conference housing program, which is our summer camps and professional conferences that stay with us in the residence halls, all of which clearly took a pause in March.
And give us can you give us an overview of the facilities, what parts of campus, what places you're in charge of managing?
Sure. So I'm responsible for all of the residence halls and apartments on campus here, as well as the facilities out at Southampton. So we have over 50 residence halls and apartments on this campus. And under a normal year, we would house just shy of 11,000 students. We typically would open up well above capacity, and by that I mean that probably the majority of the incoming first-year class would have started out in some form of temporary housing, usually tripled rooms, meaning three people assigned to a double room.
Okay. And so when do you first remember hearing about the coronavirus?
So heard about it in the news in early winter of 2020, but heard about it most specifically with respect to the campus and the impact. I was at a conference in Nashville last March, in the first week of March, and got a phone call that we would be housing students from study abroad, not necessarily even Stony Brook students, but SUNY students doing study abroad that were being brought back and would be placed into a quarantine environment, and that the campus was tapped to use our Southampton facilities for that purpose.
And do you know why they chose Southampton?
Sure. So Southampton, of all of our facilities, has empty buildings. So as I said, we open up here at high capacity, but Southampton operates. It's a very niche campus. So it houses some health science center students who are in a graduate program of study. It houses our marine science center students who are doing almost a semester at sea type experience, and then a handful of other folks. So we had capacity to be able to take those folks on there where we didn't have that capacity here.
So as the wheels started turning, what decisions did you have to make initially to handle that, those returning students?
Yep. So everything from making sure that the buildings were clean, that there were linens in the rooms, that there was toiletries in the spaces because the students would not be able to leave for any particular period of time, coordinating with our colleagues in campus dining to make sure that there was a food service for them, which was particularly challenging because there is no food service on the Southampton campus. So anything we were going to do for these students had to be brought from here by truck two or three times a day and brought back when the meals were over. What were we going to be doing for safety protocols to make sure that, because we didn't know if these students were going to come back with the virus or not. Luckily, none of them did, but we couldn't have open access to the building. So that meant the custodial staff would not come into the building and clean. The maintenance staff would not come in unless there was a true maintenance emergency to do normal work requests. The campus dining folks would not deliver the food to the individual apartments. So we had to come up with a protocol for dropping the food at the door and then individually telling the students, you can come down at this time and get your meal one by one by one, so that they didn't have contact with other folks. Making sure that there were supplies for hand wipes and sanitizer and toiletries, because we weren't expecting them to bring pillows, blankets, you know, the full scope of what would normally be a conference housing operation for us, but this one really a very limited and contained conference housing operation.
Now, you said you'd been here since the 70s. Had you had to handle something similar to this at all in the past?
Nothing like this at all. I mean, we've had emergencies on campus ranging from, you know, fires to blackouts to floods that took buildings offline, but nothing at all like this.
Did you have any contact or when you were refitting those Southampton's dorms, were you dealing with any of the perception outside of the campus in terms of what other perceptions might have been?
Myself, no, but I know that was a concern at the time on the campus. I mean, university police put folks at the entrance to the campus in case the media was trying to come on. Fortunately, they didn't. There was concern about would the parents and families of these students want to come and see their kids since they had just come back from, you know, mostly Italy, but other parts of Europe. That didn't happen. But no, most of those conversations, I think, were happening at Larry Zacharias's level.
Okay. So as it became more apparent, it would affect more than just the Southampton campus. What kind of conversations were you in about what would happen at main campus?
Lots. So I was brought in pretty quickly, and the experience at Southampton really, I think, helped us frame what we were going to do. But I was brought in pretty quickly to conversations about what would we do here if the campus took a pause. And then sure enough, not too much after that, the campus really did take a pause. So in a matter of 3 days' time, we had to tell students the residence halls are closing, the apartments are closing, you need to leave. Normally that's done over a multi-week period. Folks have time to plan to take all their belongings home with them. That didn't happen in this instance. So we had to tell students pretty quickly, pack up and go home. For folks that couldn't pack their stuff up, we had to come to an arrangement with FedEx, who is a contractor with the Faculty Student Association, to arrange to pack and ship belongings to students who couldn't. We had to identify pretty quickly who had to stay because this is their home, or had no ability to travel to home, especially if it was overseas. So we went from roughly, at that point, just shy of 10,000 students on campus, down to 1,500 students in less than a week's time, and then had to think about how are we going to compress them down into the smallest number of spaces possible, but still make sure that folks were safe by not having five or six people share in the same unit. So giving folks single rooms within a suite or apartment, what were the safety protocols. So yeah, it was some pretty extensive conversations.
So was the goal with emptying the campus was to empty as many buildings as possible? Or what was the logistics behind it?
It was emptying buildings, as many buildings as possible, but also getting the density of the campus of students actually here down to the lowest level as possible, because at that point we didn't know what the infection rate might be. So we needed to make sure that only those that truly had a need to be here because they had no place else to go were on campus, and that we were keeping them as separate as possible. We tried not to use corridor style rooms at that point, because a corridor style room means you're sharing a bathroom with everybody on the floor. So we tried to focus on getting folks reassigned into suite and apartment style units, because it's less density sharing a bathroom and a shower facility. And we were trying to keep no more than three folks into what would normally be a six-person unit. So everybody would have a single room and they would share the bathroom and the shower facilities. We closed down the common kitchens in the building because we didn't want folks sharing kitchens. So that also helped drive where we placed folks, so that everybody on campus who stayed had a meal plan, regardless of where they live. So FSA and Campus Dining were great partners there, making sure that anybody who had to stay had a way to eat.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the food, but just since we've talked to a number of students about leaving campus, once that was announced and the deadline, for lack of a better word, to leave campus was there, what were you doing and what kind of reaction or interactions were you having with the students moving out?
My direct contact with students was probably pretty limited. Spoke to a number of parents concerned about how quickly we're asking folks to leave. The direct contact with the students really would have been the folks in the individual buildings who had the day-to-day contact with them most frequently anyway. And again, there were folks who were concerned about how quickly they were being asked to leave. But I will say that most folks, you know, were gone within the time frame that we set. Obviously, there were some exceptions that were made to give even folks that weren't going to be staying on some additional time, because if folks were traveling from out of state or significant distances, even within New York State, or folks had to make travel arrangements to get out of here, you know, the 72 hours that we were providing just wasn't enough for some of those folks. So we were flexible to an extent, but also very conscious of the fact that we wanted to get the buildings closed and get as many folks out of here as we could in a reasonably expedient fashion.
Yeah, and it does sound like the food and the food delivery was a major challenge. You want to talk a little bit more about what you wound up doing?
Sure. So let me separate the food when folks were here during that period where we closed from the quarantine and isolation piece, because what Campus Dining did was that they offered food on a grab-and-go basis to anybody who was here after we closed the residence halls, whether they were in quarantine or isolation or not. But particularly with the students that ended up in quarantine and isolation, and even continues to today, we've set up an operation with Campus Dining. And again, lessons learned as you go along the way. So initially, Campus Dining was bringing to the two quarantine and isolation buildings we had meals three times a day. Their labor force, which is unionized, did not want to come into the buildings and deliver the food. So what was happening was there were two staff on campus who were willing to do that. There were more, but the yeoman share of it fell to two staff members, somebody from our area and somebody from Campus Dining, who were very, very willing to go in and drop the food outside of people's apartments. They would be told, your food is here, open up the door, get it. And when they were done, put the dirty food outside. And then campus, we have a contract with an outside cleaning service who would come in and pick up the garbage and you know, wipe down all the surfaces, but not go into the individual apartments. One of the lessons we learned was is that that wasn't sustainable. We couldn't have two people doing this 7 days a week. So Campus Dining hired an outside service, in essence, a wait staff that would be willing to go into the building. So Campus Dining would deliver to the building, and this wait staff would take the food from the vessels that the food was stored in, hot boxes, and then deliver it to the individual apartments, again, outside the door, so that students knew when the food was there. They could pick it up, consume their food, put the waste outside in a plastic garbage bag, and the waste would be picked up by custodial, and then again, the surface is cleaned in time for the next meal. We also learned pretty quickly that if folks were going to be there for 2 weeks, that they probably needed some sort of a support with linens, because linens and laundry, because we would provide the linens in the rooms, but folks want to be able to change their linens more frequently than once every 2 weeks, and probably didn't travel with enough clothes to be able to sustain their laundry for 2 weeks. So we worked out an arrangement with a vendor that we do business with to do some laundering of items already, to once a week pick up bags outside the apartments for students to be able to drop off any soiled laundry that they wanted washed. It would go out to this vendor, they would wash it, fold it, bring it back, and we'd get it to the student before they left quarantine or isolation. And the same thing with linens, we would swap out linens for them on demand if they were there for the full 2 weeks of quarantine or isolation.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you to describe a little more how the students fell into that population of needing isolation or quarantining.
Sure. So the placement into isolation or quarantine really came from the Student Health Service. So they really have been the lead on all of these arrangements since the COVID environment hit us. So student would test positive either, you know, on campus or off, would be identified to the Student Health Service. One of their staff would reach out to the student and tell them you need to go into isolation. They would have contact tracers who would speak to the student about who have you had contact with for more than just casual contact. So the students who were going to isolation would go to one building. There was a restriction in terms of capacity. We wanted to make sure that anybody in isolation had their own bathroom. So we used West apartments, because in the West apartments, there are 6 bedrooms, 2 full baths. So we would put anybody in isolation, no more than 2 people to any one apartment, so that each guest had their own bathroom. And then if somebody had to go into quarantine because they had contact with somebody, extensive contact, Student Health Service would contact that person and say, you've had contact with student X, we need to place you into quarantine. Those students had the choice of either doing their quarantine on campus or off. And there were a number of students who chose to go home and do their quarantine at home with family. But a good number of them chose to stay with us. And they would go into another building that was strictly quarantine housing. And in that instance, the ratio was 2 people could share a bathroom. So we could put up to 4 people into an apartment in West Apartments, with each of 2 people sharing their own bathroom within that apartment.
And this might be obvious, but these could be students that had never met. They didn't necessarily know each other when they were placed into these.
Could be, but quite often, if I was going into isolation, there might be 3 or 4 folks around me that I knew that would be going into quarantine, so that we try and keep folks together if they were coming from the same place together. But you're right, not always the case. And then we also had our precautionary quarantines before the start of each semester, where folks were traveling from, I guess, so-called hotspots. So initially it was really anybody traveling internationally and very much of the United States. Folks had to do a 10-day precautionary or travel quarantine. So we had provisions set up to accommodate those folks. And you're right, those folks probably didn't know each other. It was first to arrive, first placed, and they would stay until they would pass quarantine protocols. As numbers started to drop and in the spring semester, some restrictions started to lift, there were fewer people that had to do a precautionary quarantine. So the numbers became much more manageable.
Yeah, and I just wanted to ask you, who were those two people you said that was doing the bulk of the food delivery in the beginning?
Sure. So one was Eduardo Diaz, who is from our shop. He is the interim director of residential education, and he manages all of our apartment areas and specialty housing. So because the West apartments fell under his domain, he was willing to do this. And the other gentleman was Van Sullivan, who's the executive director of FSA. Again, 7 days a week, these folks were delivering food into the building, and it wasn't sustainable. So when we got past the summer, we needed a different plan. And that was the plan I spoke about with the outside delivery service.
Yeah. And we're actually talking about, this is hard to believe, a year after the beginning of these events. So can you walk us through the decisions for fall 2020 and into spring 2021 in terms of how your use of the buildings changed, or did they change? Or
sure. So I think we've spoken about the quarantine isolation piece, so I'll speak about the other student housing. So lots of meetings over the course of summer of 2020 at all different levels of the institution, but we were really taking our guidance from the CDC, from New York State Department of Health, from SUNY, as well as from our medical experts here on campus in terms of what it was safe to reopen the campus. And in all honesty, the plan that was put in place that was approved by SUNY said that if we had 10,000 students that wanted to live on campus, our plan was sufficient enough to allow 10,000 students to come back. In reality, that wasn't even necessary because students told us that they weren't comfortable coming back. So we went from what would normally be 10,005 or 10,600 students living on campus down to 4,500 students living on campus. And many of those were folks that were taking all online classes, but just felt that they wanted the campus experience, whatever that was going to look like. Others were folks who needed to be here because labs were starting to open up again and they needed a presence in labs. And again, there was still that group of about 1,500 students where this is home for them, regardless of what's going on out in the outside world. This is their permanent home until they leave Stony Brook as students. So we went from 10,006 down to 4,500. So we tried to spread folks out as much as possible. We did a lot of reassignments over the summer to create less density, because obviously in March when we closed up, students who were on campus at the time had already chosen their assignments for the next academic year. So we were pretty dense, but now we were looking at less than half the normal population. So we wanted to reduce the density, spread folks out as much as we could. We tried to keep folks in the building that they were in, that they had originally selected to live in. And then, of course, we filled in the first year and transfer students around them to the extent that we could. Shortly after the semester began, we were asked to take a building offline for an additional building of quarantine housing. So we looked at an apartment building in West Apartments because that's where our quarantine works the best. And we took the building that had the least amount of density at the time and moved those folks to other spaces within West so that we could create another space. And the rationale behind that was we didn't know what the infection rate was going to be, but there was a belief that the two buildings that we had offline already, one for quarantine and one for isolation, wasn't going to be sufficient. So we created a third building and moved some number of students to other spaces within the West Apartments. Then about a month later, we were asked by our colleagues in campus operations if we could compress some buildings that had some really low occupancy down to create some savings in labor costs as well as utilities. So we ended up closing three residence halls, one in Mendelsohn Quad, one in Mendelsohn Community, one in Roosevelt Community, one in Tabler Community, and at the end of the fall. So we told folks just before Thanksgiving that we would be closing their buildings and then gave them new spaces. And they were able to move to those spaces before the campus took the Thanksgiving pause because many students chose to go home from Thanksgiving till the start of the spring semester. So when they came back in the spring, they were in a new space and those three buildings were offline for the rest of the academic year.
So can you give us a sense of your day-to-day? Where were you working out of, or you know, your command center? How were you?
Sure. So command center has been my office since day one. I mean, I'm out in the field and a fair amount of the time, but the command center has really been my office and talking with, you know, folks all across campus. I mean, I have daily conversations with my colleagues in Student Health Service. Marissa Pisciani and her team have been wonderful. Larry Zacharias has kept me in the loop of, you know, just campus decisions in terms of things that we're going to be doing. So that's a part of the conversation. Rick Gatteau had a team of folks, I mean, outside of his normal leadership team, which I sit on, a team of folks that would speak, you know, regularly about what was happening in numbers. Communication to students was a key piece of this. So working with Sonia Garrido from Rick's team, who, you know, obviously is the point of contact most frequently with MarCom, to make sure that any messaging that was going out to students as well as to staff was properly vetted and was clear. But I'd say some of the biggest challenges of the time were that things could change almost multiple times in a week, if not during the day. That a message that we would communicate out at 8 a.m. might be, you know, outdated and need some refreshing by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and certainly by the next day or the day after that. So things were, you know, consistently evolving and making sure that we all talked to one another frequently and consistently, so we all knew that we were on the same page. Looking at websites so that if something changed on campus guidance about quarantine and isolation, that we made sure that our website reflected that and that other websites that had that information reflected that as well, so that folks were getting the most accurate information at, you know, almost on a real-time basis.
So if I understand you, you were coming into work every day, pretty much.
I was. I work remotely one day a week, and that's been the case really since the pandemic hit. It made sense for me to be here given the things that I was involved in, and I can also get far more things done being in my office than working remotely. It's just my resources here are just more extensive than what I could set up at home, although I know for many folks, working at home was the better environment for them.
Sure. So if you look back as you decrease the density, what did it feel like on campus once it was empty?
You know, so having been here as long as I have, I'm used to in the summertime, this still being a vibrant campus, you know, being able to walk around the campus and see folks and lots of activities going on. So starting with the summer, really even starting in the spring when, you know, normal traditions that we would expect like Roth Regatta and Strawberry Fest and some of the other traditions just not happening. The campus was very, very sparse. You know, I say I stayed in my office, but, you know, my office was always a very vibrant hub because we are the central office for all of the housing operations on campus. Folks would be in and out of here all day long. Students would see us as a place to go for information, whether by phone or in person. And now it was, I don't like the word ghost town, but it was really very sparse to the point that, you know, there were days that the only time I came out of my office was to use restroom facilities, or if I needed to pop into somebody else's office just to check, touch base with them. I mean, Zoom became our friend, you know, almost immediately. And that face-to-face contact with folks on campus as well as in our office became very, very different.
And what building are you in?
I'm in the campus residences office, which is in Mendelsohn. It's in between two residence halls, Irving and O'Neill.
Okay. And so would you see people on campus, or how frequent, rare or frequent was that?
So again, I would see people on campus, but I mean, you could look across the academic mall sometimes and see a handful of folks, where on a normal summer day, if you were out and about on the campus, I mean, the campus would still be pretty bustling, even though we're not at full capacity. And during the fall semester and even into this semester, you know, as you're out and about on campus, you really don't see much. You see folks out there, but it's you know, very, again, sparse is the word that comes to mind. I'm not sure that it's the best word, but the density of the campus was definitely much lower when you'd be out and about and not see the vibrant campus life that you're used to seeing.
Sure. And how did the pandemic affect your life outside of campus?
So it clearly did. You know, I have folks that were close to me that caught the virus. Luckily, nobody passed from it. And I know that I say that not lightly, because I know a lot of folks did. But I do have somebody close to me who is a long-termer who's being followed for long-term symptoms. I have a close family member who I have not seen in over a year because they live out of state. So now that I'm vaccinated, I look forward to being able to do that soon. And the literally the last time I saw them was the first week in March of 2020. And, you know, we talk on FaceTime frequently, but there's no substitute for being able to see somebody. I don't see close family members. I'm also somebody who is very cautious about dining out. So when I leave my house, I tend to go to the grocery store, to grocery shop, really very little else. If we're dining out, it's takeout back into the house. I've been in a restaurant once during all of COVID, and that was to celebrate somebody's retirement, where I really felt like I needed to be there, but was uncomfortable from start to finish because right at the time it happened, we were really in the heat of the infection rate, and I wasn't really very comfortable being in a restaurant, but I also needed to celebrate this person's accomplishments in retiring, so I did go.
Were there any routines you found yourself, new routines falling into, or things that you picked up to help you pass the time as you could?
Lot more reading for myself than I did before. I mean, I like to read, but sometimes I have to push myself to read, but clearly in the last year, a lot more reading. I will take rides in the car a lot more, but not whereas I used to take a ride in a car to get to a destination. Now it's more just driving around. And if I go someplace, like if I go to a beach, you know, I may not get out and walk around. If I see other folks out there, I may just stay in the car and take in the, you know, the beauty of the beach, you know, from the car or, you know, from at my car. One major change in this year is that I got a puppy, you know, which was something that, you know, my family and I were thinking about for a while. We had not had a dog in the house for a number of years. So that has certainly helped fill the void at a very challenging time. I mean, you bring any puppy into a house, but we brought a Labrador puppy into the house, full of energy and likes to get into lots of things. So having that puppy there has helped brighten up the house in what would normally be a more challenging time.
Sure. And what would you like people to know about this time in your life and what you experienced?
I will say that it is life altering because, you know, I don't know that anybody except for maybe somebody who has lived through the Depression or maybe, you know, a pandemic in the early 1900s, if for those folks that are fortunate enough to still be alive, has ever lived through anything like this before. You know, I have a new appreciation for folks that really struggle financially. I'm very fortunate that, you know, I still have a job, but there are lots of folks out there that don't have jobs, either because their place of business is no longer in business or because the nature of the work that they were doing wasn't conducive to the COVID environment. I appreciate every minute that I have with my family, knowing that there are folks who lost folks that will never be able to see or speak to those folks again. This truly is a life-altering experience. And I think that, you know, while we are making progress as a country or as a world, I think that COVID is with us for many years to come in whatever shape or form it's going to take. And we're going to have to adapt the way that we live our lives and the things that we do to continue to be safe and keep ourselves and those that we love and just society in general safe.
Is there, just looking back at your long career managing residences, does this change how you think they should run, or what effect do you think long-term it will have on campus housing?
There is clearly a this generation of students want single rooms. I mean, that's been known to us for a long time. And when you're talking about buildings that were built, very many of them in the 60s and 70s, campuses were building traditional double rooms, whether it was a suite or a corridor-style room. So there was already a disconnect between what students wanted and what we could offer. Now with COVID, students are absolutely much more vocal about the fact that they would prefer to have a room to themselves because they're just concerned about being around other folks and maybe those folks not taking the correct safeguards to keep themselves or others safe. So it does make me think how many students will ultimately choose to come back, at least in the fall, but if not long-term. I mean, how many folks will choose to say, either I will commute if I'm able to commute, or I will just continue to live in a Zoom world. And I also wonder how many folks will not have the financial resources to be able to come back to live on campus, even if there's a desire to do it. So I think that we are going to have to shift the way that we do business and better react to those folks that are concerned about their privacy and try to find ways to accommodate that given that we are a self-sufficient operation and we can't just say, well, we'll make every room a single room, because to do that would mean that rents would go up to the point that most folks couldn't choose to live on campus. So it's finding that tipping point or that balance between making students feel that they're safe living on campus and also being able to provide the financial resources to sustain what we do and do it well.
Well, Al, I want to thank you again for sharing all those memories with us, and we wish you all the best going forward.
Okay. Thanks so much, Chris.